When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to So Very Wrong About Games. It's a new year, it's 2018, and here we go. A wise man once said, a house divided against itself cannot stand. Thank God we're sitting down. I'm here with my friend Mark Bigney. How are you today, Mark?
I'm quite well, Walker. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. All right, so this year we're going to mix it up a little bit more. Instead of what our usual order, we're going to do the games we played this week, then the news, then our feature game, and then our topic, which this year is New Year's resolutions. And to start off, let's do an errata. Last week, I talked about Baron Park, where on my list, it was next on the list, where I had meant to say Patchwork. So if listening to last week's episode, every time I say Baron Park, just insert Patchwork, and we should be good. Baron Park is not a Uwe Rosenberg game.
Indeed not. It was designed by Phil Walker Harding. We regret the error. It's a great tragedy. Everyone has suffered tremendously because of our momentary lapse.
I have beseeched my co-host's good name in the gaming community, and for that, I do not apologize.
Good to know.
All right, so games we played this week. What do you got for us first, Mark?
Well, one game we played was we pulled out Through the Desert again. Through the Desert is a 1998 somewhat classic. I'm not comfortable, even though it was from the previous century and now 20 years old, I'm not comfortable with calling something a classic unless it's truly, truly ancient. More on all that later. But this is a Reiner Knizia tile laying game involving pastel camels. I adore this game. I've been playing it for years. It's not always a huge hit because it's a very dry game, no pun intended. It's a perfect information, no luck game, and also that tends to be somewhat punishing for newbies. You know, the experienced player at the table might conceivably double the score of people who don't know what they're doing. It also has a minor unfortunate element in that a lot of the early decisions are front-loaded. The setup can be very, very determinative of how the rest of the game plays. It's not nearly as bad as Settlers. I've seen lots of games of Settlers where after the initial setup, someone's just completely out of the game and they don't have a chance. Yeah. Through the Desert is definitely not that bad. But all that having been said, all those negatives out the way, Through the Desert is a masterwork. It's an absolutely brilliant game. If you haven't played it yet, give it a shot. It's been recently reprinted, as I understand it. Every edition has had the all-important pastel camels. My edition has 8 languages in the rulebook, which is an advantage. I now know how to say pastel camel in 8 different languages.
And that will come in so useful in the future. I can see many instances where you would use that.
I can travel the world.
It's true.
There are no doors closed to me. I know how to say pastel camel, so everything's solved.
Yeah, it's a great game. It's been on my shelf forever, and I hardly ever get it to the table, but as soon as I played it once, I loved it. Not very many games. I haven't seen a game use that mechanic.
Yeah, people have described it, I think, somewhat accurately as multiplayer Go in a way, because it is very much about blocking off people, blocking off territory on the board and controlling that, and very much about controlling tempo. It's, you know, for multiplayer abstracts of that nature, of very deterministic positioning games like that, they tend overwhelmingly to be 2 players. And so the multiplayer ones, when they're good, tend to be very versatile and good. Through the Desert's one. Another game is Fealty by Eric Royce. That was the first published design of the guy who did Spirit Island. I'm not a huge abstract fan, but the ones that do work, I quite enjoy. And Through the Desert deserves its high status, and I'm glad it's back in print.
Yeah, and scales very well, you know, whatever players. Not so much with 2, but I mean, anything above 2, I think it plays the same, if not better.
Yeah, it does very, very subtle board changes for multiple people and subtle things with the camel supply, but no,
and the fact that all you're doing is placing 2 camels, it goes around the table quite quickly and plays out nothing overly complex.
Absolutely.
One of my games is the Santorini by the same company, Roxley Games, the same company that did Steampunk Rally. and they redid Santorini with gorgeous board game components and all god powers like they had in the old one. Just a lot, whole bunch more. They had a huge Kickstarter, and I think it looks gorgeous on the table. Really easy to learn. Either you have to move, place a building. If you can't do that, you lose. If you get to the level 3, you win. Nice, basic, quick to set up. Plays out wonderfully. I think we got like 10 games in like half an hour. It was great.
Yeah, it's a beautiful production. I actually really like the original production as well, the sort of austere, abstract white and black elements of it. But yeah, the new edition is beautiful. It's getting a mass market release, apparently. Isn't it showing up in Target stores?
Yeah, that's what I've heard, that there's a Target edition. Although it seems as though the one that I got is the Target edition, because it says all of the rules for the Golden Fleeces is included in the main game. Where when you look at the rules online, sure enough, in that rule book they're included. But in the one that I got, that I did not pay the Target price for, there are no rules for the Golden Fleece. But who knows what the deal is with that. Maybe it's the Canadian edition.
Huh.
I'll look more into that later.
Yeah, Santorini's great. It's one of those games that's very much not for me, because it's very puzzly. It's a very puzzly kind of abstract, which it's just, I'm just not able to do. I'm too dumb. Can't do it. But yeah, you're right. Plays quickly, simple, great game.
All right, what's next on your list?
We played Beowulf the Legend, another Rainer Knizia game of old, back when he was designing good gamers games. Beowulf the Legend got a very bad rap when it first came out, in part because I think people were expecting something slightly different. It looked a heck of a lot like his Lord of the Rings co-op game, which in many ways sort of gave a shot in the arm to the...
Yeah, very heavy on the symbology, right?
Yeah, the symbology, it's the same artist, which definitely adds to the impression that they're going to be similar. This is a push-your-luck hand management game, and it reminds me a lot of another Knizia design, which is Taj Mahal. Taj Mahal I've never really enjoyed. I want to like it. It's a game I respect more than actually enjoy, but Beowulf is very similar in that you've got these cards, you know that you're going to have these challenges with other players where it's basically a function of chicken, and it's got this additional element of gambling on top of the chicken, which works really well. A lot of people think that it's too luck dependent, but I actually think that much of the game is knowing when you can afford to bust. It's a question of every time you basically pull the lever of the slot machine, if you will, people often don't know when they're able to pull it. It's just if you can't handle the negative consequences, you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. And so some people say, it's like, oh, if only this had worked, then I would have been fine. It's like, well, no, you shouldn't have gambled in the first place. You weren't in a position where you could gamble. Anyway, I really enjoy the game. It's really accessible. It's only really good with 4 or 5. But it's one of those underappreciated gems.
It's true. I was surprised how much I enjoyed it. But I want you to tell me where this theme comes through in this game. Where is Beowulf in this game?
Okay, here's the deal. I'm of two minds about this, and I've read some interesting articles on both sides. A guy by the name of Chris Farrell, who's got his own blog called Illuminating Games, and he also comments prolifically on Board Game Geek. He and I are on the same page on a lot of things, particularly war game design and thematic integration. He's also a big Knizia fan, and he thinks that Beowulf is about as thematic as Euros get. And I'm sympathetic to his overall point, because his basically, I'll try to encapsulate it this way, and I'm probably not going to do a good job. If you look at the original stories, and similar kinds of epics of similar age, it's about bravery, it's about courage, it's about knowing when to get punched in the face, it's about outlasting whatever challenge gets thrown at you. And Beowulf is very much a game that evokes that feel. Most of the time, we as gamers expect adventure games to be all about, you know, rolling hit dice for combat. And if it doesn't have that, we naturally assume that it has nothing to do with adventure or anything like that. But Beowulf is instead about challenge and daring and risk. And that's what it seeks to emulate in those sort of epic stories of adventurers and heroes. How far that gets you, I don't know. I appreciate it primarily on a mechanical level. And it does indeed signpost you. It's like, well, this is when you're partying with Hrothgar, and this is when you're fighting the Sea Hag, and this is when the dragon breathes fire in your face, and someone will die. So that, you know, those elements are very much the sort of par for the course in game design. The events are entitled after famous scenes in the stories. And sometimes it's very evocative, like when the dragon attacks, someone's probably going to die. So that, I think, is really clever. But look, how much theme you're going to get out of it, I think, is largely a function of what it is you're expecting, what it is you're looking for. But if you let the game speak for itself, I think you're going to get the broad brush of a sort of a bunch of not necessarily too smart, adventuring Middle English dudes who are going to go and punch people in the face and get punched in the face in turn. And whoever's left standing with the fewest scars, or at least the best stories about those scars, will win. All of this is to say I don't find it particularly thematic, but I don't think it's as unthematic as people say that it is.
True enough. Next on my list is the new one from Portal Games, Alien Artifacts. I only played it once, so I don't have a lot to say about it. Usually when I play a new game, I look for the hook, right? What does it do that's new? What is it that's going to bring it back to the table? And I didn't see it in the first playthrough. Not that it was a bad game or anything. I definitely want to try it several more times. But it's a really neat game. It sort of employs their 51st State, Imperial Settlers, you know, three different categories, cards on both sides. It doesn't really pull a lot from other than that, but I really like it. All the cards are double-sided, so you can either have them, you know, as active or deactive, and they give you all sorts of different abilities, and everyone has their own unique powers. So I'm looking forward to more plays.
So it's another card-driven tableau builder, right?
Correct.
How much... I did, having read the rulebook, I will say the following. Number one, it is probably one of Portal Games' better rulebooks. I haven't played the game myself, so maybe it's one of those rulebooks where you read everything seems to make sense, you sit down to play and nothing makes sense. But I didn't seem like that. It did certainly seem like the fact that all the cards are double-sided and can do multiple duty. Does that give you a sense of freedom or flexibility, or is it just overwhelming?
No, it's definitely... freedom and flexibility, because not only can you see the three next cards that are available for purchase, but when you go to purchase those cards, you can pay a little bit extra and draw multiple cards off the top and choose from those. And then once you do get them, and you even have a quick reference chart and tells you what's on the back of, usually the other side is the same on most of a category. So it'll say, okay, in this category, they're all going to be like this. So you don't have to constantly pick up a card so you can't see what the next one is. It's that type of card, so the back is going to say this. That being said, I want to get back to what you're talking about, the rule book. We literally did not even read the rule book. They had to watch it played. We watched that and just went in right to playing when we just referenced the rule book when something was unclear.
Yeah, I don't...
Is that going to be the future of rule books?
I certainly hope not. But maybe rule books are so bad now because people know that no one uses them. Who's to say?
Well, why do they not use them, right? Because they've been so poorly written in the past, maybe. I'm not sure. Like, it's one of these...
Some people genuinely prefer to have rules explained to them, and that's fine. And for those people who would like to skip the rulebook and have it explained to somebody who's very good at explaining rules, that's cool. I personally would prefer a universe in which those people who are very, very good at explaining rules write all the rulebooks instead. But that's not going to happen, so we're left with designers writing the rulebook in the last 5 minutes, not blind playtesting it. And then the good people like Rodney and Paul Grogan receive these scattered nonsense documents and try to force it into some semblance of making sense, but...
There you are. What else do you have on your list, Jerry?
We played Tajemnice Domostvo, which is the Eastern European version of Mysterium. And I've got the older Polish edition, which is not even as old as the Ukrainian edition, which is, I believe, what the first edition was. And I slightly prefer the Eastern European version to Tajemnice Domostvo to Mysterium. I like the artwork a little bit better. I think the rule set's a little bit cleaner. The salient rules difference between the two is that in the American version in Mysterium, you bet on whether your friends are right or wrong on their guesses, which introduces a very strange dynamic that I don't quite enjoy. A pseudo sort of hoping your friends will fail or it's just it rubs me the wrong way. The one thing that I really hate, though, about Mysterium, and this is one thing that I strongly prefer the Eastern European version, is in the Eastern European version, in the end game, you can still collaborate. In the very final stage of the game, you can still talk to your friends and try to make your case as to why you think a certain answer is correct and help people out. In the American version, in the end game, you're not allowed to speak to each other. It's all secret. And I don't like it when cooperative games try to shackle you or say, okay, now everyone's playing by themselves.
That's right. Suddenly put a point system in and say whoever has the most points is the actual winner. You don't win as a team, even though you've been a team for the whole game. Now we're going to throw some points in at the end and, you know, there's going to be one winner.
Yeah. Similar problem. And there's even another minor consequence. This almost never happens, but it's actually the case that if you are too successful in Mysterium, if you're correct all the time, you're actually penalized in the endgame. You actually need enough time to make wrong guesses to accumulate enough points so that the endgame is easier. It's a bizarre set of things, and it's a little clunky and too many components, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, all of that having been said...
But it's got the screen.
The screen is beautiful, yes. Absolutely. The screen for Mysterium is great. The Eastern European edition needs absolutely at the minimum a card holder, and a card holder is probably insufficient. A screen would be better. And I do enjoy the game in whatever form I play it. It's Clue meets Dixit. You know, it's the cooperative game of trying to give people dreams. The asymmetry is nice. Being the ghost, the one giving the clues, feels different from receiving the clues. The sweet, beautiful recriminations that people hurl at each other. It's like, my job's, your job's easy, help me out here. No, my job's the hard one. You don't understand how easy you've got it. That kind of tension I do enjoy. It's great for non-gamers as well. They're not going to understand how the game works until it starts. I mean, at the core, it's very simple. It's like, here are some pictures, associate them with this other picture. And then the rest of the structure becomes clear later. Anyway. Always a great time.
Yeah, I was surprised how well it's been accepted by the Saturday night group, right? We're usually Ameritrash wargaming, and suddenly we're playing this abstract, you know, storytelling card game. I was pretty surprised how enamored they are with it.
It's a great game.
Yeah.
One last game that I'd like to talk about is... So last night was New Year's Eve, and we went to a New Year's Eve party, and we played Trivial Pursuit. And I hate Trivial Pursuit. Here's the thing. First of all, I hate trivia games. Trivia to me, and this is a minor terminological quibble that I'm not actually going to rest on, but I don't think trivia is much of a game, because either you know the answer or you don't.
How about Wits and Wagers, though? Can we just throw a quick side in for Wits and Wagers?
That's why Wits and Wagers is the definitive trivia game, as far as I'm concerned, because it recognizes that actually coming up with the right answer is not really a game. You either know it or you don't. And it's also the case, another thing that Wits and Wagers does, that Trivia Pursuit fails miserably, is Wits and Wagers understands that for reasons of consistency, it's good if all the questions are formulated the same way. Every question in Wits and Wagers has a number as an answer. Part of that is just by necessity, but part of it also helps, and I don't know if this was deliberate or not, it helps streamline the questions so that they're all the same format. In Trivial Pursuit, it could be true-false. It could be choose from this list of three things. It could be pick a name, pick a number, pick a place, or any of these combinations of things. First of all, Trivial Pursuit, when played by the actual rules, is going to take you 7 years. It's absurdly overlong. And that's even assuming that you're playing with smart people. If you're playing with idiots, you're never going to end. And I was at the table, so you knew at least that some of that wasn't going to come to a conclusion. We played by dummy rules to quicken things, and even then it was taking far too long, and it was blessed relief, even to the rest of the people at the table who were more inclined towards trivia when the thing finally came to an end. There were, I would say, a solid 10% of the questions made me furious because of how bad they were. Just because of how badly they were formulated, or because it sounded like marketing copy. Some of it sounded like ads, honestly. No joke. And any time there was a question about a subject where I knew even a little bit, it was sometimes grotesquely inappropriate. Like, you could ask somebody who's an expert, a 100% expert on the field, and they wouldn't know how to answer the question because they wouldn't know what specifically you were looking for. I'll give you the specific example. Let me just... I hated this game. The question was, what radical group was responsible for the Reign of Terror during the French Revolution? And it's like, well, look, there were, you know, three or four prominent intellectual clubs that people were members of. There were three or four prominent cults of personality, effectively, around these people that were sometimes coextensive of, but not necessarily reducible to, those social clubs. There were the broad social movement called the sans-culottes. There were a variety of flash political parties that grew. What on earth are you looking for? They were looking for one of the social clubs. Not even the only one, just one of them. It's like, so here I am, if I'd received the question, I didn't. It's like, well, I could list you half a dozen things that could answer that question. I don't know which one you're looking for. They were looking for the Jacobin. And sure, the Jacobin were very influential. And you could write a decent question where Jacobin is the only answer, but don't write me a question where there are six different answers. It was a huge deal. What caused the Reign of Terror? I mean, come on, guys. Like, lots of things did. Anyway.
So, and it has roll to move, right? It's the best, and it has roll to move.
Yes.
And Wits and Wagers is a question that is asked to every player, and they all get to answer. Like, I think it's an amazing game.
Yeah, Wits and Wagers is by far my favorite trivia game. I'm not a huge fan because I still don't like trivia. But yeah, you can then... It was designed explicitly as the trivia game for people who don't like trivia games, and it did a great job. So please, if you like trivia, and you have a copy of Trivial Pursuit, burn it. And go get yourself Wits and Wagers by Dominic Capuchet. It's infinitely better. Anyhow.
There you go. On to the news we go.
On to the news.
There was tons of news. Like, I don't even know where to start with the news. Truth be told, there is lots of news. And none of it interested me whatsoever, except for one thing. And that is DC Spyfall. So there's going to be a Spyfall game set in the DC universe where the Joker's the spy, and you're going to be have the locations like the Batcave and all sorts of like cool superhero settings. And there's going to be a variant where someone can play Harley Quinn, where their job is to give Joker clues of where they are, but everyone has an opportunity to point to, like, same as, you know, Avalon type game, sure, where they can point in who they think Harley Quinn is, and then they all lose. But I think it's going to be for the geeky, you know, comic nerds out there, this is going to be a fantastic variant for Spyfall.
But how many jobs are they going to be able to put for something like?
I don't know. They're going to have like henchmen and mad scientist and
lackey, but
and
say the location is the Batcave, or even worse, the Fortress of Solitude, right? How many jobs can you put there? Because one of the things that I think makes Spyfall sing, or at least gives a lot of context, is when people play to their specific roles printed on the card. It's like, well, we're on a cruise ship, but I'm a waiter. I'm a fat tourist or whatever. I'm always the fat tourist, but that helps. It gives a little flavor, a little tooth, a little bit of comedy to the tension. But if it's the Fortress of Solitude, what are you going to be, the polar bear outside? Like,
it could be the snowflake or the chair or the chamber where you lose your powers. We're going to have to wait and see.
Sure. Well, I've got one bit of news which caught my eye. I think I'd read this before, but I didn't see any details. So after abandoning its partnership with Fantasy Flight Games, Games Workshop apparently is now going to be partnering with WizKids.
WizKids, yeah.
To be releasing board and card games of the universe. The first thing they're doing is a 40K Dice Masters thing, which, yeah, I find doubly uninteresting. I didn't really like the Dice Masters line, and I don't really care about 40K, except for one prominent exception. But who knows where this is going. I mean, as we've commented before, WizKids is making a major push. They've been redoubling their efforts in the hobby market to varying degrees of success. So this, to my mind, I'm curious where it's going, what they're going to be doing, because Games Workshop is now redoubling their efforts as well.
Apparently they've already announced a Fury of Dracula going to be reprinted again.
So that's an obvious candidate.
Who knows what that's going to look like?
Yeah, that's an obvious candidate. That game, I don't like it, but it deserves to remain in print. Although, really, it had its third edition 2 minutes ago.
I know. I'm not sure what kind of legs it's going to get if it does come out again, unless they change it up again. Who knows?
Sure. It's just a strange world. I don't understand why they broke the previous licensing arrangement. Maybe Fantasy Flight wanted too much money. Maybe Fantasy Flight didn't want to do it anymore. Maybe it was they were angry about the Rune Wars miniatures game. I don't know. The only other thing that caught my eye is slightly more details about the new edition of Eclipse. I'm of two minds about this. I resent the fact that publishers can make me buy a game twice, but I'm just enough of a sucker to keep doing it anyway.
I'm afraid I'm in the other boat on that one, because both with Gaia Project and this Eclipse, like, I never bought Terra Mystica, and now I've got what I feel is the better edition, which is the Gaia Project, and I like Eclipse, not, you know, over the moon about it, but I never ended up picking up, and now that there's going to be a second edition, you know, why not?
It's just another opportunity for early adopters to get shafted. And as that early adopter, I can't complain too bitterly, because I keep falling for it and I keep giving them money.
They know.
They know.
All right, so that is the news. And on to our feature game, which is Space Hulk. Mark, why are we talking about a 30-year-old game?
We're talking about a 30-year-old game because it's still amazing.
It is. All right. Let me set the stage. All right. It is 1986. The movie Aliens has just come out. One of the greatest science fiction movies of all time. 3 years later, two board games come out. One Space Hulk, the other Aliens the Board Game. And they go head-to-head, and Space Hulk wins out hands down. Why?
Well, Games Workshop certainly has something to do with it. And the fact that even in its ancient first edition, the components were vastly better. We've talked about this before. The Aliens board game has some of the worst components of all time.
Yeah, these are the points I was going to make too. Games Workshop backing it, already have a fan base, already have some history in the 40K universe. And then, like you said, the components just blow it away, right? Full miniatures, components, everything else, as opposed to like literally perforated cardboard that you punch out yourself.
Really badly perforated,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. Which is unfortunate because the game itself was very good.
Yeah.
Why has Space Hulk won out over 30 years? So my points is just straight up theme. The theme of this game is ridiculous. So let me set up the theme of Space Hulk. You're in a passage and it's all quiet and suddenly oh, your face is ripped off. So that is Space Hulk in a nutshell. You think everything's all nice and quiet. You think everything's going great. And then not so much. Death and despair for everyone. It's one of these games where it's not the first all against one. And it's not really an all against one. It really is a two-player game. But it's one of the very first where you're playing sort of against the game. One player's playing the game master type thing, and it's you know, do or die, struggling against all odds to get your objectives done. And I think they did a fantastic job with it.
They captured the theme, the essential tension of the sort of Aliens setup. I think the comparisons to Aliens are sometimes overblown. But that central tension of these swarming clawed horrors everywhere is very, very well captured in Space Hulk. That feeling of... It's actually... One of the things that I find really fascinating about it is, as you say, you've got this plan and everything's going fine. And you feel, as the Space Marine player, almost invincible sometimes because you're heavily armed and you've got range and they don't. And you're just stomping along, murdering everything. And then everything can go south on a dime, and it usually does. And then things start to fall apart and you're swarmed. And that is, I think, in part, a testament to the core rules, which I'll talk more about later in a second. But it's also a testament to the scenario design. That's something I'd like to stress right up front. One of the reasons why I think this game has stood the test of time is the scenarios are really, really well designed. Especially the first one, Suicide Mission, which... Very much like Upfront, another game of that era. Upfront is a game where you can basically recreate lots and lots of different levels of World War II combat with armored fighting vehicles and tanks and off-board artillery and things like that. Most of the time, I think 90% of Upfront players never do that. They only play the first scenario, meeting engagement, over and over and over again. In part because it's a good scenario and the rest of the stuff is overcomplicated. Similarly with Space Hulk, Suicide Mission is so good that is often all that Space Hulk players play.
It's true. It was like several years, at least 5 years before I had pulled it out. And I pulled the game out and I set up Suicide Mission without even looking at the map with like one mistake to a tile. It was like, how much I've played this game.
And this is actually a parenthetical objection I have with the newest fourth edition. Because it's had four editions. 1989, 1996, 2009, 2014. The 2009 and 2014 editions are more or less the same, except the 2014 edition has a couple extra scenarios. But as a result, and I can't believe they did this, Suicide Mission isn't the first mission anymore in the fourth edition. It's not scenario number one.
Really?
One of the new scenarios is scenario number one.
That should not be allowed.
That seems
sacrilegious.
That seems absurd. I can't believe they did it that way. And look, we both have played other scenarios, and other scenarios are good. Most of them are more sprawling. And that's okay. But Suicide Mission not only is really good and really tense, but it's also just a really good introduction to how the game works, because you're not given a whole bunch of special units. This is a little less true in the third and fourth editions, but in the original one, it's just, you know, four guys with storm bolters and one guy with a flamer. Keep the flamer alive and torch this room. That's it.
Yeah. All right. For those who have not played Space Hulk, it's like an action-based point system. You get five Marines go in. They each have four action points a turn. You have to finish with a particular Terminator before you go on to the next. You spend your four action points either shooting, moving, all sorts of different actions. Then the Steeler can go, and they get to start with cool chits that are blips, just like from Aliens. It's like just movement. In some of the versions, they're actually just zeros. It was just movement like rats, or it could be diversions, or it could be anywhere from one to three in the standard game. In the other games, when they're up to six, sometimes ridiculous numbers. And then if they come in with a line of sight, then you flip them over, and suddenly it's the Genesis' turn. They have six asymmetrical. They both have different powers, and you know, basically different, right? So they have six action points as opposed to four. Way better in hand-to-hand combat. We used to say that Gene Stealer versus Terminator combat reads like a Gene Stealer menu. It's like, Terminator smoothie, you know, rip off top, insert claw, blend to preferred consistency. And it was great. It was one of those great moments, right? Because in the combat, Terminator rolls 1d6, whereas the Gene Stealer gets to roll 3d6, and the highest die wins. So it's almost impossible. But those moments where it's the crucial, and the Terminator, you know, either stands off the Stealer's last action point or actually wins the combat, it's like one of those, you know, moments you talk about for days to come.
Absolutely. Every session of Space Hulk that I've played has had at least those great moments of tension that a lot of games aspire to, but many don't. One of the core mechanics of the game is Overwatch. You put these Marines on Overwatch, and they basically fire at anything that moves. That's another change they put into 4th edition, by the way, that I don't approve of. In 4th edition, you don't have to fire when on Overwatch. You get to choose.
Yeah, that's my one big
Also sacrilege.
With each edition, they seem to take more and more tools out of the Gene Stealer arsenal, and you might as well just make it, you know, card-driven or app-driven or something else, because if you take away all these tools, it doesn't become a game for them anymore, right? If their hands are tied on all these things, well, you can't, you know, move it in out of the hallways to make them shoot or stuff like that, then, I don't know. I didn't like the change, but...
Yeah, it's... But to me, the quintessential Space Hulk experience is when the Gene Stealer has built up a sizable force of Gene Stealers, and a Space Marine is on Overwatch, and it's just a question of, can they get to him before they're all mowed down? And this happens in many scenarios, if not all of them. And it's just, I move a space, roll to see if he's dead. I move a space, roll to see if he's dead. And part of the gamer brain of me is thinking, this is actually kind of dumb. But because the asymmetry is so well done, because the scenarios are so well done, and because it's just genuinely tense because you know of this asymmetry, it's really, really engaging. And then you hope... You know, as a Space Marine player, you hope you don't jam. You hope you blow them all away. As the Gene Stealer player, you figure, well, sooner or later, I'm going to have my moment. Because that's very much what it is about the Gene Stealer moment. Gene Stealer player, knowing when to seize that moment. And it's just such a compelling, tight design. And I wish, you know, Games Workshop, I rag on them all the time because I don't have any interest in Warhammer 40K or Warhammer Fantasy, which is now called Age of Sigmar. But when they do boxed games, they often produce really good stuff. I mean, back in the heyday, they had, you know, Warhammer Quest, they had Necromunda, and they had Mordheim. They're bringing back Necromunda. They've brought back Warhammer Quest. They've got other weird stuff like Gangs of Kamara, which I haven't tried. A game called Deathwatch Overkill, which is probably the quintessential 40K title. They, you know, Revenge of Grimdark, Urge of the Necrofiends, I think is probably going to be the next thing they put out. Blood Bowl has been basically more or less in print for about 25 years. Not really to my taste, but a solid design. And it's great that they're coming back to this. When in 2009, when they were reprinting Space Hulk 3rd Edition, it came completely out of nowhere. No one was expecting it. It was just so welcome because they have all... When they put their minds to it, they're able to put out these really compelling designs.
Yeah, that was the golden age. I was just looking up, like the year before that, that's when Blood Bowl came out. And in this year, when Space Hulk first came out, so did Hero Quest and Advanced Hero Quest. All came out in that same year.
Yeah.
And so did, funnily enough, the very first edition of Arkham Horror. Not the Fantasy Flight one.
Yeah, the Chaosium Returnalis one.
Yeah, that was the same year that came out, yeah. That being said, what was I going to say? We're not going to talk about the bad things. I'm talking about that this was the game that did it for me. Like, literally, I went to a gaming convention. All I played was 40K. They didn't really have the Terminators out then. You knew about them, but not so much. I came upon this game, and they were playing, you know, the 20-turn defense mission, which is, I think, is the second best mission in the game.
I like it, too, yeah.
And I just thought that these were some sort of, like, weird robot, you know, turrets, and this was some sort of tower defense game, and these aliens were coming in, and I was just blown away by, you know, because I'd never seen it. Of course, I played, you know, the Axe and Allies and Risk and all these other games, but I had not played anything like this, you know. And I, you know, I was, you know, in my 11 or 12, you know, I got my dad, he wrote out a check off to, you know, like 100 miles away, you know, paid ridiculous shipping and a ridiculous price. Like, you know, this was 30 years ago. And $100 for a board game, we think, is a lot now. That is how much I paid for that game 30 years ago. And it came, and I put the models all together with two-part epoxy, not even plastic glue, got them together. And, man, was that game overplayed. It was, like, worn down to little nubs. It was well-received by everyone, for sure.
Well, since we're sharing stories of nostalgia, my first experience with Space Hulk was actually with the PC game, which was a strange attempt to... You can do it turn-based, kind of, but it also tried to introduce a sort of real-time version, which kind of made it look like a first-person shooter. Anyway, it was a strange, albeit noble effort. And it had this incredibly memorable, cheesy song during the opening, which stuck in my head. Anyway, that was my first exposure to it. And when I was exposed into the broader world, my first kind of hobbyist game was actually Battletech. And when I was exposed to Space Hulk at the time, I was 13, 14. I didn't know any better. And so I didn't like how simple it was. You know, I thought, well, shouldn't I be able to build a Terminator with like a list of 50 million different options and things like that? No. you know, I was infatuated with customizing things, and everything needed to be customized. Like, no, look, Space Hulk is what Space Hulk is. And over the years, they've tried to introduce things like, you know, you could play as Imperial Guard, or you could bring the Eldar or whatever. I noticed in the latest issue of White Dwarf, you can introduce Gene Stealer cults. I'm not persuaded that any of that is good for the game. It's the core simplicity, that strong asymmetry between the ranged powerhouses and the basically whirling balls of razors, I think, is what sells it.
Yeah, the very chess-like movement. You know exactly how far the Steelers can move.
Yes.
You know exactly how far you can move. You know where you need to go. And it's just, you know, making that decision, that key moment. Am I going to round this corner this turn? Am I going to have what it takes?
Yeah. It's a very deterministic game, which is actually one of the things that I least like about Space Hulk. It's very... I've talked about this already. I don't like puzzles. And usually in Space Hulk, some of the key decision points revolve around little mini puzzles. How do I solve this particular corridor challenge? It's less about tactics and more about sort of a spatial puzzle in many ways. And in almost all other games that have spatial puzzles like that, I want nothing to do with them because it's just not to my taste. But Space Hulk pulls it off because of, again, the tightness of the gameplay and the compelling nature of the theme and the asymmetry. And yeah, Suicide Mission is a puzzle that I have yet to, thankfully, because of all the different ways that different players can approach it, and because of the influence of dice, it's not a solvable puzzle. That's why, again, I'll still play Suicide Mission any day of the week, because it hasn't been reduced to a simple algorithm whereby it's obviously solved. There are good plays and bad plays, and I'm not going to say that, you know, someone can reinvent the wheel. It's a relatively constrained scenario. There's no room for incredibly bold masterstrokes of strategery. But nonetheless, there's still room for clever play, knowing when to push your moment, knowing how to take care of it and cover the odds. So yeah, it's the most puzzly game that I love, probably.
All right, are we done stroking the E-peen of Space Hulk? Now, do you have any bad points you want to bring up? My bad points are just the dice rolling. So in Space Hulk, you're rolling D6s all the time, and sometimes they can be very unforgiving. And that's all I have bad to say about it.
For me, it's less about the die rolling during combat and more about the command point pulls. Because one thing we didn't mention, for those who haven't played the game, yes, all your Space Marines have four actions, but collectively they can share a pool of command points, which means they can do extra actions, and you get 1 to 6 every turn. If your leader is still alive in the third and fourth editions, and I really like the third edition. I agree with you that there are some features of first that I miss. Second edition was just weird. Let's just set it aside.
Yes.
But if your leader's alive, after you draw, you can redraw. But sometimes, if you're just stuck with 1 or 2 command points every turn, you never really get to 4, 5, or 6, it can be really tough and really frustrating. Because, again, this is a game about pushing your luck and knowing when to make that big push. And if you never get a lot of command points, it can be real, real frustrating to do that.
Yes, these command points, you supplement your Terminator's action points with. They each get 4, and whatever you draw, a number between 1 through 6, you can supplement at any time, even during their turn, after their turn, during the Gene Stealer turn, you can supplement. Well, depending on what edition you play, you can use them, but you can supplement your actions with these command points. So I've thought of all sorts of different ways to change it up, but unfortunately, the way that they have seems to be the most balanced for now, even though it's the most hair-pulling outage.
The rule set is so simple and so clean. It's very resistant to house ruling. You change one little thing and everything might go out the window. And that's part of its strength and part of its weakness. It's, you know, classics are the way they are for a reason. And, you know, for a hobby that is always obsessed with the newest, latest thing, this is one of those few games that can unambiguously be called a classic. It had been played for many years, even before Settlers came out. So,
for sure. So this is a game, if it was not in your collection, you'd gladly buy it again?
Oh, absolutely. Look, here's the thing. It's an expensive game, and as I've said, I'm throwing far too much money at the hobby as it is. But I spent a moment trying to think, if I own a game that is more physically well-produced than Space Hulk 3rd Edition. It has these thick, embossed tiles. If you've never seen a Space Hulk 3rd Edition tile, I encourage you to go try to look at one. It's got physical detail on it. It's not, you know, like miniatures terrain or anything like that. But the artwork it's all very grimdark, so if you don't like that, it's not going to do anything for you. But the embossing is beautiful. They're thick, thick, thick tiles. The miniatures, of course, are gorgeous. Some of the Gene Stealer models are a little too big and bulky, so they don't quite fit. I guess that would be another minor complaint. I wish the Gene Stealer models had that same level of detail, but some of the poses were a little more functional. But everything in that game is absolutely beautiful.
I'm torn between these new miniatures and the old miniatures.
Really?
Well, there's something to be said about lining up like a whole hallway with all these Stealers, you know, streaming down all in the same pose. You know, it just has this more imposing look to it than all these like weirdly shaped things, you know, wherever. I know, I'm old school, I guess.
To each their own. I don't know how old school you can claim to be, though, Walker. This is another complaint I have against the game. That's that Walker doesn't play with the timer. Why don't you play with the timer? Let me set it up. Here's the thing. And this is actually one of those great things about how a game design can subtly influence players' perceptions of the game, both thematically and mechanically. The Gene Stealers are supposed to be lightning quick. Incredibly fast reflexes. They're very, very speedy, and they're quick, and they can change on a dime. The Gene Stealer, the Terminators, on the other hand, the Space Marines, are supposed to be these plodding, very deliberative figures. So as a result, what they do, and this turning it on its head really fascinates me. So the Space Marines, being slow, have to play on a timer, which means that the Space Marine player has to play fast. And that encourages mistakes. A friend of mine back in Cambridge always used to say, play faster, misplays are interesting. And he's actually absolutely right. Misplays make games interesting, especially when they're puzzle-like. And that pressure on the Space Marine player to act quickly both represents, number one, the fact that they are physically slower, and that mismatch, having to play faster because you're slower, is great. And it really helps amp up the tension, because you know that you've got this incredibly deliberative series of puzzles to solve, but you don't have the time to do it. And so it helps increase that sense of panic. Meanwhile, the Gene Stealer player, because the Gene Stealers are lightning fast, get to take as long as they like with their turns. Now, this I guess could sometimes lead to AP, although I've never experienced someone taking too long. But again, because they're so fast, they get to play slow, I find really interesting conceptually. But you don't play with the timer, why not?
Well, I had an answer, but then I discontinued while you were talking. More like, just like you said, there was never an AP problem. The Space Marine player always went quickly. But then, while you were talking, I thought, just having the timer there, is going to mentally affect you and make you make mistakes. So it's probably a better idea to use it. It's just like I said, when we played, it was never, you know, so essential we win. We're just so having so much fun playing it that the Space Marine player didn't overanalyze anything. He just took his turn, did what he needed to do. He never like took back moves or anything. It was just like, this is what I'm doing. This is, you know, my group going through this death house.
The timer, I think, is the single most thematic component in the game. It's the single component that helps sell the theme better than any of the sculpted Space Marines. And parenthetically, I would like to stress, I don't know how you feel about this. When I'm talking about the theme, I'm talking mostly about the feel that you get when you're playing the game.
Exactly.
We talked about this a little bit before we talked about theme. To me, theme is successfully executed when it gives you a good feeling or an evocative feeling while you're playing it. The rest of the theme, the story, who these jerks' names are, the fact that they still are sending infantry fighters into massive ships to fight these aliens, like, none of that makes any sense, and every time I try to read it, it sounds dumb to me. I'm sorry if it's your bag, but every time I try to hear their explanations for what the hell is going on in these aforementioned space hulks, it makes zero sense to me, and it just sounds like this artificial excuse to get the gameplay to work out the way that it does. So the broader theme I find absurd and unsatisfying. For me, it's just that tension, that specific feeling of tension and being overwhelmed.
Well, that's the other thing I just thought of while you were talking is, if this movie Aliens had not come out, would you have the visual feel and the sense of tension and the theme of Space Hulk? Would it be there as much as it is without that movie?
Probably not.
I think it really did. Like, thinking back, I think it was an essential part to this game.
Yeah, because the Gene Stealers are obvious Xenomorph ripoffs. You know, the Ridley Scott movie, Alien, when it introduced that creature, just visually and viscerally, just the sense of that creeping killing machine was so incredibly influential, both in terms of cinema and even just in terms of board game design. So I agree, I don't think we'd get that same conceptual hook if we hadn't already been exposed to this creature in the movies. That having been said, it's now sort of... So Games Workshop rips off the sort of Giger-esque Ridley Scott monster. They rip it off wholesale and they make an entire faction out of it. And now, many years later, they're getting their own just rewards because Blizzard's StarCraft is basically ripping off vast sections of 40K lore visually and thematically. So I guess what goes around comes around.
Also, I want to talk about, remember the first edition box said it was a 3D role-playing game?
Yes. Interesting claims.
Yeah, I wonder if that was just to, you know, lure in the role players out there thinking that they were going to get some sort of science fiction aliens game.
Yeah. And I've seen, like I said, there's this document that was kicking around for a while. I don't know if it's still being updated, called the Space Hulk Bible, which had all these hundreds of pages of additional rules and different factions you could use and blah, 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 blah. There might very well be campaign modes kicking around. And indeed, since every game now has to have a campaign, I'm sure there are some people clamoring for a campaign.
There was a campaign book that you could get. It's a hardcover book that they sold.
Yeah. Did it have, was it about like individual Space Marines surviving from mission to mission?
That I don't remember.
Because
I know I had it, but it was so long ago. I don't remember if there was like an ongoing, like, I know I made one myself about keeping stats and bringing Terminators from mission to mission, but whether this book did it or not, I'm not sure.
Which always struck me as kind of odd. I mean, it is, even before you play the game, the first mission is called Suicide Mission, and it's called that for a reason, because people are going to die. And all these, even though as a Space Marine player, you've only got, you know, usually 5 to 10 Space Marines against an unlimited number of Gene Stealers, those guys too are disposable. You know, no one's making it out alive. This is all about, everybody dies. So I never quite understood the push for campaign elements. It's the same thing that I said about Massive Darkness. Some games don't want to have campaign modes.
That's right.
And to me, Space Hulk is definitely one of them.
Yeah, it falls in the same thing. It doesn't need a campaign mode. It doesn't need a fifth and sixth player.
Exactly.
So that's Space Hulk. Multiple computer games. Four editions of the board game. Even a card game based off of Space Hulk.
Yes.
I think it's definitely, you know, resisted the tides of time, and it's still a fantastic game.
Absolutely.
So on to the topic. What's our topic today?
Today we're going to be talking about New Year's resolutions in gaming. So We're recording this on the first day of 2018. And so this is an opportunity to look ahead to the new year and what we want the new year to look like in gaming. And so I've got a whole bunch of... I spent some time thinking about how I want to spend my time gaming in the coming days. Walker, what is it that you want out of 2018?
Speaking of gaming specifically, like actual gaming, just be welcoming to new players. Make sure all new players are welcome. Be patient. Like, we're trying to grow this hobby. Try not to make it the click that sometimes it turns into. When people are coming by your table, don't just wave them off like, oh, they won't understand, they don't get it, or they don't... Try to show them how fantastic this hobby is, how these mechanisms work together, and how that moment when your whole plan comes together and you see the game, you know, when, you know, the designer has made this game for us and he knows, you know, that moment where you see his vision come to life, and try to show them how this happens. That would be... Hopefully I can get that to at least 10 people this year. That would be fantastic.
It's funny that you put it that way, because you start off talking about how important it is to be welcoming to people, and then you immediately start talking about the game as a collection of mechanisms rather than a social experience. And I point this out because I'm the exact same way. I have that same set of assumptions and weird blinders. I have the same thing written down. I have written down, start being a better evangelist for the hobby, because... It is about people, and I came to a realization very shortly on in as a board gamer, which is that who you're playing with is often more important than what you're playing. I commented before when talking about Twilight Imperium 4th Edition, which is an overlong game that I loathe, but I still had a good time because I liked everyone else around the table, and you know, we could joke and talk, and it was good company. All of that having been said, it is important, you're right, to resist that temptation to be like, well, I'm sitting down with my friends in this public venue. Everybody else can go leave. And this is especially troubling for new players, if either because you don't know them or because you do know them and they're a little bit annoying, which sometimes happens. And you're right, you're much better at this than I am. I'm sure this will surprise zero of our viewers. Walker is a much more tolerant individual who's much more welcoming and gregarious of new people. I hate people. I like my friends, but I hate people. And I need to stop doing that, because it is important to grow the hobby, and it's especially important to be welcoming, particularly to and also just to be conscious of the fact that gaming is overwhelmingly dominated by middle-aged, overweight white dudes. And so you need to be especially welcoming to people who are maybe in their 60s and 70s, maybe the new kids in their 20s or whatever, women and minorities. It's important to make sure that this hobby can continue, because if it comes to if we're doing really well right now, but if the market turns and they stop putting out new stuff... then we're just going to be, you know, 70 years old playing the same old stuff and
playing old games. No,
well, no,
that's not going to happen.
that was
if it's not out this week, then I'm not playing it.
You understand my point?
Yes, for sure.
What else you got, Walker?
I've got researching Kickstarters more, just because it's shiny and wonderful models, and it's by, you know, a designer and or a company that I enjoy or has always put out good stuff. I'm going to, I shudder at the thought, actually read the rule book first and not just blindly pay the money and wait for it to come up and decide then whether it's good or bad.
Yeah, as a corollary to the whole nobody reads rule books anymore, it used to be the case that people demanded a work in progress rule book before they would pledge. And now people aren't even happy with that. They want to see a video of their favorite quote unquote board game journalist playing the damn thing. Or of even a rules explanation of a video rules explanation before the game is released. But whatever it is, yeah, doing your due diligence before Kickstarters. I don't want to get complacent. I think I got a reasonably good handle of this in 2017. I stopped pledging for things unless it was only going to be available through Kickstarter, or if I knew I'd be able to sell it on the secondary market for a profit. Yes, I'm one of those people. I don't buy things exclusively for a profit, but I do. I feel a little bit more comfortable pledging if I have a reasonably good sense that if I don't like the game, I'll be able to flip it and get something good out of it.
Now I want to go to my next thing. I know I'm doing two in a row, but it's the other side of the coin. You were just downstairs, and you probably saw the gaping holes because I bought another shelving unit. And even though I said I got to do my due diligence, those holes need to be filled. They're like holes in my heart. If those holes aren't filled with games, these big gaping spaces in my shelf, then I'm not a whole person. So I'm going to be working on that as well.
Best of luck with that. Well, as a corollary to being somewhat nicer and being a better evangelist for the hobby, this was actually pointed out on Reddit. We had we had some feedback on Reddit about our podcast, most of which I think you said you dutifully ignored because you said, no one can tell me what to do. I am a god among men, which I thought was a little... I mean, that was a strange comment to make, but what, you know, whatever, to each their own. I think I need to make a distinct effort to start being more tolerant of interruptions. Not during the gameplay itself, because I think I'm pretty tolerant in that when it's someone's turn and they pause to take out their phone and look at it, I haven't, you know, smashed it in their face immediately, which is normally my inclination. But mostly during game rules explanations. I take game rules explanations very seriously, and I put no small degree of thought into how to do them. I used to be an educator, and so I take this rather seriously. I try to use signposting and lattice work, and I'm usually very conscious of when I introduce which concept when. And so when someone asks me about, you know, endgame scoring, when I'm just introducing the notion of a turn structure, I'm occasionally, what's the word I'm looking for? A huge asshole. And I should probably stop doing that, again, under the aegis of being more welcoming. So I'm gonna devote myself in 2018 to being a more conscientious rules explainer.
More welcoming, like when people are new to the game. So they feel more welcome.
Exactly. Or even people that I've known for maybe all of, you know, 2 weeks or something, and they're not ready for me to be a tremendous douchebag.
They don't understand that we're doing it for comic relief. And not personal.
Sure, it's a joke. Let's go with that. Let's totally go with it being a joke.
Yes, exactly.
Similarly, this is kind of a corollary that I'd like to start being a better playtester. A couple of designers, because they clearly have no judgment in character, occasionally have me playtest designs or ask me to. And I'm a little better at saying no now, but I still say yes far too often, in part because I'm not particularly good at dealing with print and play components. I'm not very good with crafts. I'm not very handy. I'm clumsy. I've got sausage fingers. I don't have a good printer or anything like that. And I'm also just very bad at convincing people to playtest games with me. So I need to be a little bit more conscientious about that. We ourselves emphasize the need for blind playtesting and for sending it out to other groups. And it's all very hypocritical of me to say, yes, people need to do this, if I'm not willing to put in the effort myself to help that. And so to that end, in 2018, when I say I'm going to try to help someone with a design, I'm going to try to follow through and be a better person about that.
Yeah, if we don't make steps forward to make changes, then no changes will be made.
Yeah, I think it was Reiner Knizia who said, be the change you want to see in the world. That was him, right?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. So in terms of what I want to play in 2018, I spent some time thinking about it, and I think we've gotten pretty good, especially lately, at balancing new stuff with old stuff. We're still, you know, members of the Cult of the New for all intents and purposes, and we probably play far more new games than lots of other members of the hobby, but we've gotten better at pulling out our old favorites so that they stay in rotation. But one thing that I do want to do is play more two-player games. Things like Space Hulk, things like Claustrophobia, things like Shadespire, just in terms of, you know, the Game Workshop Conflictathons, but also other things like Battlecon. I got a new game recently called Sakura Arms, which is a two-player card battling game that looks interesting that I want to try. And I've gotten out of the habit of trying to, you know, specifically play two-player games with people, and I'd like to get back into that. As a consequence, also, I'd like to... I didn't play nearly as much tabletop miniatures in 2017 as I wanted to. I'm a huge fan of Infinity. It's one of my top 10 games, and it's my favorite miniature system. I'd like to play more Infinity in 2018, which is also a two-player game. Maybe this is the year I finally give War Machine a try, but I always find excuses not to.
Legion's coming out. Maybe that'll be the miniature game. I know there's a bunch in our group that are looking forward to it. They just showcased even more stuff that's going to be coming out. And it's Star Wars.
Oh, for the love of all things good and holy. I'll try it, sure.
That was one of my things I was thinking about earlier, too. My New Year's resolution is to get down, because now I have the space, is to get some more painting done. So we'll see if people are more inclined to Legion, then there's that I might paint. And there's also the new CMON steampunk game that's shipping soon, Rise of the Moloch.
Another type of game that I like to play more in 2018 is war games. You know, the actual consens, the historical war games. I've been trying to get a game of Triumph and Tragedy together forever. Successors 3rd Edition. You know, the really brilliant hallmarks of the genre. Those are the multiplayer ones. Obviously, playing more two-player games, that would include more two-player war games as well. I've had a little bit of difficulty finding local partners for a variety of reasons, but who knows? Maybe 2018 is going to be my year. Also, splatter games. I want to play more splatter games in 2018. I've been just re-exposing myself to some of their earlier stuff. Antiquity, I brought down off the shelf first time in a long time. I don't know if you've tried that.
No, I've heard of it, though. I definitely want to try it.
Oh, great. Well, then that'll be great. More Food Chain Magnate, all the great splatter stuff. Maybe sometime in the future, one of our users actually suggested that we do a segment on splatter games as our feature topic, and maybe we'll do that sometime in the future, especially after...
Gallerist? Splatter game?
No.
No? I know the automotive one is a splatter game.
Kanban?
Yeah, is that not... I'm going to stop talking now.
But they were all designed by Uwe Rosenberg, right?
They're all Uwe Rosenberg games.
All offshoots of Feast for Odin, right?
Please, yeah. And well, I thought for sure that Kanban and...
No, very much not. Splatter is Food Chain Magnate, Antiquity, Duck Dealer, but not a lot of people like that. The Great Zimbabwe, Roads and Boats. Indonesia. 2018, I was pretty pleased with 2017, both in terms of the releases and my ability to play games, and I'm hoping that 2018 will be another banner year. And but most of all, I guess my resolution in 2018 is to keep doing this podcast and keep telling you,
also true.
Yeah. Telling you how wrong you are.
Telling you how to play games properly, because I think that's my main mission, because you're doing it wrong, and I will guide you on the right path.
It's a very noble man.
Yeah, I'll take the hit for everyone.
So that, I think, just about wraps us up on our topic of 2018 and our New Year's resolutions.
It sure does.
So with that in mind, thank you very much for joining us once again for So Very Wrong About Games, and we hope to see you week after week here in 2018. You can find us on Facebook. Our Facebook group is where we get most of our correspondence, and we read all your comments, and I try to accommodate them. Walker just likes to read them to ignore them. If you would like to send an email directly to Walker to tell him how wrong he is, just send an email to justrolledadice@gmail.com. That's JustrolledaDice, because Walker also can't spell.
Just a quick note, if I don't read them, then I can't really ignore them. So I have to, unfortunately, read them so I can purposely ignore them.
It's a process. It's a very important process. You can find me on Twitter @allthegamesyoulike. Thank you very much for joining us, and we hope to see you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoeseteat.com. You can reach us by email at soveryronaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter @sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.